Welcome to Giants Double Play, the San Francisco Chronicles podcast on Major League Baseball. I'm your host, Janie Hu, the Chronicles' assistant sports editor, and I'm joined, as always, by our Giants beat writer, Henry Schulman. Hey, Henry. Thanks for joining us on another episode of Giants Double Play. We are 1 week roughly into the season now. You've had opening day and experienced it in Los Angeles with a four-game series against the Dodgers. The Giants came back and had their home opener in a two-game series against Seattle. So we're six games in. The fans have really been up and down. You've been hearing about it on Twitter. What's your take on the Giants so far?
Well, I mean, 3-3, not bad, considering that a lot of fans had to have their, you know, sharp objects taken away from them after the two shutout losses in L.A., assuming the Giants were going to score a total of about 11 runs between now and August. So considering all that happened, they've done okay. It's been an odd start to the season. You don't usually start the season with four shutouts, two going your way, two going the other way, and then two completely diametrically opposed games that you had at home, where they gave up four runs right away in the home opener with block pitching, and then they scored four runs right away in two innings against Felix Hernandez. So, you know, it takes a while before you sort of get a real sense of where the season is going. Given everything that's happened with the Giants, given the fact that they did have that huge scoring drought, scoring six runs over their first five games and lost two starting pitchers, and starting with four games in a row against your rival and the team that is coming off winning a pennant, I think 3-3 is a pretty good place to start.
Well, you pick up, I'm going to give a shout out to our Sporting Green sports pages. If you pick up the sports pages today and you look at the standings, you got the Giants at 3-3 ahead of the Dodgers at 2-5, so there's always that too.
Well, yeah, let's see what that looks like on August 31st
when we do
episode 103 of this podcast.
No, you've always said, and I loved how you explained this when we started doing these live streams last year, is that you take a season and you break it down into nine innings of 18 games each, and so kind of the first clarity or marker for you might be after that 18-game mark.
Exactly. I mean, that's the bottom of the first inning after 18 games. And I really think it takes about 40 games, a quarter of the season, basically in the third inning, before you can even, you know, kind of get a true sense of what the team's strengths and deficiencies really are. It'll be a little more awkward with the Giants this year because they're not going to have their full team. And, of course, when you have a team that has some key guys injured like Samardzija, Melanson, and Bumgarner, what you really just hope to do is sort of stay the course and stay in the hunt until they get back. And when they do get back, it's almost as if you're making free trades to get new players. And I think Samardzija is going to be the first one back, barring a setback. We may see him around the 15th or the 16th of April, which is coming up pretty quickly. Bumgarner, we know, is about June 1st. He hopes to make it sooner than that. Melanson is a big question mark because, I mean, he has inflammation. He's not on a throwing program. He's on just waiting for the inflammation to die down. I don't think anyone needs to or anybody can really count on him any time on any particular date. The bullpen's doing okay without him so far. So that's a plus for the Giants as well.
Right. So we're here talking. I'm in San Francisco Chronicle headquarters, and we've got you dialed in on the phone. I'm sure our listeners can tell the difference. And this is something that we hope to be doing regularly so we can check in with you remotely when you're on the road, and our Giants fans can listen to the dulcet tones of Henry Schulman every week.
Yeah, you know, we'll just have to arrange this around my poker games and trips to the synagogue, but, you know, we'll get these done when I'm on the road.
So speaking of synagogue, we talked about starting pitching, and we had Johnny Cueto take a perfect game into the seventh inning on Good Friday. And, to give fans a little bit of background, papers kind of not, I wouldn't say go into panic mode. It's really no hitters are great things for the fans and people watching the game, baseball itself. But we here in the newsroom go through a very different set of steps that we take. We start calling people and preparing for, oh gosh, if we really do get a no hitter or whatnot. The Associated Press sends out no hitter alerts. The tradition has been after six innings, but I think it all kind of talks about just baseball traditions. And what do you guys think in the press box? I mean, it used to be this big thing. We can't mention a no hitter before six innings are over.
Well, first of all, if there's a Pulitzer Prize for segues, you win it for that synagogue Easter Good Friday thing. The tradition in the press box is to flout any kind of dumb superstition that if you talk about a no-hitter, it's going to go away. I can guarantee you that every no-hitter that's ever thrown in the history of baseball, people have been talking about it in the press box, in the stands, in other countries, in space on the shuttle, space station or whatnot. I mean, we're not witches, we're not warlocks and things like that. I mean, no hitters can't be won or lost or made or broken by somebody talking about it. AP sends out an advisory in the sixth inning just to make sure that all the papers that subscribe to it know that you may have a big story coming soon. The weird thing about Cueto's, of course, was that the Giants hadn't scored a run. They were facing Kershaw. And a pretty good Dodger bullpen. So when you're writing a story, well, actually, when you're writing any kind of no-hitter story, you're always writing as the game's going on because you've got to file it final out. It's always a little nerve-wracking because as soon as somebody gets a hit or a walk or whatnot, I mean, it really changes the whole tenor of the story. But when the team that is throwing the no-hitter doesn't have a run either, and you're looking down the line going, well, I don't know how they're going to get a run, then it makes it even a little more nerve-wracking, which is why I have an endorsement deal with Maalox.
Sounds good. I'll try this for another segue. We talked about you looking down and, man, where's this run going to come from? It's fair to say that the hitting has not been the most spectacular by the Giants, especially their newcomers, Evan Longoria, Andrew McCutchen, Austin Jackson. I saw that you had this theory that it's okay for the hitters you thought that the hitters were a little bit behind coming into the season, and that was because of this truncated spring training?
Yeah, I mean, I talked myself in and out of that theory just because I've looked around baseball, and there have been a lot of I wrote a story that was put on the web on Wednesday in the morning about how many really good hitters in baseball have struggled. I mean, Chris Davis of the Orioles was 1-for-20, and there were all sorts of examples like that with really good hitters who Jackie Bradley Jr. and Anthony Rizzo and Ian Happ and all these guys who were having some sort of numbers like McCutchen, Longoria, and Jackson were having. But then on the flip side, there were 25 guys who were hitting over 400, I think it was. So I kind of talked myself out of that theory, and I just think what happened with the Giants is it is natural to press when you come to a new team. Longoria and Jackson are coming to a new league. They're all playing in ballparks where they really haven't played all that many games. I mean, McCutchen obviously has had his fair share of games in Dodger Stadium. The Giants were also facing a pitching staff that helped lead a team to a pennant. So I think that had something to do with it. But the new guys tend to press. And when you have three guys in the lineup who are all starting off slow and they're all pressing, that can happen. And then we kind of saw Longoria starting to break out of it. You can tell even when a guy makes an out that the at-bats are better because, the guy's going deeper in the count. And even before he hit that home run in the home opener, he had an at-bat earlier in the game where he took a really tough 2-2 pitch. I mean, it was the kind of pitch he would have swung at in his first few games. He took it for ball three, and then he hit a long fly ball to the warning track at center. And you get a mental picture going, okay, Longoria's right about to bust out of this, and then in his next at-bat, he hits a home run. Well, I saw some of those at-bats yesterday from Andrew McCutchen. First of all, he drew a walk. Second of all, he made a long out to center and a long out, not a long out, but a hard out to right. This was on Thursday in the 10-1 win. So that's telling me that McCutchen's getting a little more comfortable. Jackson, I don't know. I mean, he's in a platoon, so we'll see how he does. I mean, his strength is hitting left-handers, and, the Giants have faced a lot of them and will face some more of them. But the bottom line on all of this is that it's a small sample size, and people like to panic. And, you know, it was a historic start to the season badly. I mean, with two runs in the first four games, no Giants team had ever done that. And then, of course, you see them come out and score 10 runs and pounce on a former Cy Young winner. So it can change in a heartbeat.
Right. Speaking of a different panic, Joe Panic also kind of off, on the flip side, off to a historic start of sorts. No other team had had their, I believe, their first three runs of a season scored on home runs by the same person.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, that's never happened before, which is, and also I think that the Giants, I believe the Giants also were the first team ever to win their first two games 1-0 on homers by the same guy. Actually, I think it might have been the first time in history, if I'm not mistaken, that at any time of the year that a team's won back-to-back 1-0 games with a homer by the same guy. I mean, he looks like a different hitter this year. He really does.
Ed, would you credit for that? It goes to maybe the hitting staff tweaking some stuff with his approach?
Yeah, John Shea wrote a little bit about that in a story that ran in the Thursday paper. The Wednesday paper. They made a little bit of an adjustment with him, more of a not so much with the actual plane of his swing, but more with how he positions his feet, and that allows him to stay back a little longer on the ball. And he's always been a good contact hitter. I mean, he's been the toughest hitter in the National League to strike out the last 2 years running, which is a really kind of important feat to have. So all you have to do is you just get him to hit the ball on a line a little bit more than he has the last couple of years, and maybe not 40 home runs, but you can predict that he's going to be a 300 hitter or close to it if he can maintain that sort of swing and approach, which he was a 300 hitter when he first came up in this league, and if he could stay healthy and keep the same approach, he actually could be a decent leadoff hitter for this team.
Right. So Panic is obviously off to a hot start. We had Longoria join the long ball party. Another guy, blast from the past, here comes Pablo Sandoval, and it's like the Pablo of old.
Yeah, and it's funny, as we're talking here, recording this podcast, I'm watching the Red Sox in an extra inning game against Tampa, and I'm just sitting there thinking about the executives of the Red Sox, watching these highlights on MLB Network as they come on at night, and just going, "We're paying him $18 million. We're paying him $18 million. We're paying him $18 million." And I mean, I Giants fans need to remember that whatever Pablo gives them this year, they're paying $545,000. That won't even get you a garage rental in Sunnyvale right now. It's a huge thing what he's going to bring to the Giants this year. The kind of bench presence that they really haven't had the last couple of years, the last few years, a guy who can come up there in the ninth inning against those tough right-handed closers and put a little thought into the back of their minds that they have to be careful with him. The ability to play third base, the ability to play first base, which he's done a decent job with, even the ability to catch if need be. I mean, Bochy talked about this last night. A lot of the younger fans may not remember that Pablo Sandoval came up as a catcher. He was a catcher when he first played with the Giants, and they converted him to third base. And he has been taking bullpens. He caught a Johnny Cueto bullpen before the season actually began, and then took credit for Cueto's near-perfect game because of that, which was kind of funny yesterday. But having Panda on the bench as an emergency catcher even allows Bochy to pinch hit Nick Hundley without fear that if Hundley's out of the game and something happens to Posey, that he's out of catchers. Bochy even mentioned that last night because he actually used Hundley in a pinch hitting situation without fear of not wasting his or spending his two catchers before the game was over. He brings a presence to the clubhouse. He can hit right-handed again now that his shoulder is healthy, his left shoulder. He's not a burner, a barn burner hitting left-handed. You're not going to start him too many times. I'm sorry, right-handed. You're not going to start him too many times facing left-handed pitchers, but you can pinch hit him against a left-hander if you need be. a really big addition to this club.
Yeah, and you talked about this in your write-up from the game yesterday. It's that you've got Panda back, you've got Johnny Cueto looking really strong out of the gate, and these are guys that have personality and a presence, and it's not a knock against Buster Posey or Madison Bumgarner, but they're less of the rah-rah guys, correct?
Yeah, they're the quiet professional type hitters, and I would actually put Longoria and McCutcheon and Jackson in that category. Now, we don't know really how these guys' personalities are going to mesh with the rest of the clubhouse, because when guys are new, you tend to be quieter and you tend to let sort of the team leaders sort of set that sort of tone. I saw it a little bit with McCutcheon. I saw him breaking out a little bit with a very funny conversation he had in the clubhouse right before the end of spring training that, you know, is private. I won't get into it. But, he was making people laugh in the clubhouse, which was good to see. And, you know, I have to say, too, that the Giants were a very homogeneous team and have been a very homogeneous team. And, you know, without getting too much into nationality and race and all that, clubhouses do tend to be a little bit louder and more boisterous with a Latin presence, because Latin players are not shy about playing their music in the clubhouse. And this is something, I'm not making this up off the top of my head, this is something that players talk about. Cueto even talked about it last year, saying that it was a very quiet clubhouse, and it might be a little more boisterous if there were more Latin players in the room. And you have not just Latin players, but boisterous and good guys. I mean, guys like Sandoval and Blanco and Gorkys Hernandez, who are respected by their teammates. And when you have younger Latin players like Reyes Maranta and Roberto Gomez, you know, a couple of pitchers in here, you know, guys they can look up to too. And it just sort of loosens up the clubhouse a little bit. It's not as homogeneous. It's not as quiet, and that's something Bruce Bochy really wanted to see this year a little bit more than last year.
Right. So speaking of Longoria and McCutcheon, where did they end up setting up shop in terms of their lockers?
Well, Longoria has the locker that's closest to the food room, the training room, and that area there. It's sort of in the neighborhood where Matt Cain was last year. McCutcheon is over in another corner, sort of an opposite corner. He's not far from Pablo Sandoval, and he sits next to Austin Jackson. It's funny. All three of the newcomers, Longoria, Jackson, and McCutcheon, all happen to be lockered together in Dodger Stadium. And I mean, usually those things are done by numbers. And I mean, you had 10, 16, and 22, but the three of them, I noticed, sat there quite a bit, and we're talking to one another. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if there's sort of a bond between them or among them, because you have these three veteran players who are all new, and maybe they forged a little bit of a bond through that in spring training. But Jackson is lockering next to McCutcheon in that one corner of the clubhouse near where Cueto and Panda are right now. Cueto is in the old Barry Bonds suite of lockers. It's been remodeled a little bit, but you don't have these gigantic lockers that Bonds used to have, but that's where Cueto is now, and Panda is where Bonds' third and fourth lockers used to be, and McCutcheon's around there near where Sergio Romo used to be, it's a bit of a smaller room right now, and a little more togetherness. That's where it is. Relievers are still pretty much together. The starters are pretty much together. The infielders are pretty much together, and then Bumgarner and Posey, who are the two. Really the two team leaders, the two veterans, the guys who've got the three rings and been here through the wars, they share a suite of about three or four lockers in another corner.
Okay, so that's kind of designated as the cream of the crop space-wise?
Leadership. Yeah,
okay.
Leadership. Yeah. It's a set of lockers. I think it's three or four lockers that are set off by themselves. In one corner, so they really don't have to, dress with a whole bunch of people nearby and don't have to be crowded.
Right. Well, I think it's going to be an interesting storyline to follow how these new guys eventually, assert themselves. It is a little bit like, showing up to the high school in 11th grade when everybody's been there together since 9th grade or whatnot, and you're
exactly.
A little bit hesitant at first. You don't want to dominate, and you're kind of just feeling your own way around first.
Yeah, I don't really see Longoria just doesn't strike me as a guy who's going to put the lampshade on his head and be a, you know, ha-ha party guy.
Mm-hmm.
I can see that a little bit from McCutcheon. I really can. And Jackson, I don't really have a great read on. He's a very nice guy. He's very helpful and accommodating to us. I'm looking forward to kind of learning a little bit more about his personality.
Right. So we'll go back to the start of the season, which has been strange in a lot of ways. Not that, you know, the Giants opening on the road isn't strange, but then they come back and they have their home opener, a two-game series against Seattle, which, you know, this interleague play, it's not necessarily meaningful for rivalries or anything like that. And then here come the Dodgers back for another long series. How odd is it that these two teams, their biggest rivals, are going to see each other how many times in the first couple of first week and a half?
It's seven out of the first nine games.
Seven out of nine.
And
okay.
ten times before May 1st. They're actually going to play the Dodgers 148 times this year. I don't know.
Seems like it, right? Yeah.
Baseball has tried to sort of put the division rivals together in April and then again in September, both to generate interest at the start of the year and to have these rivalries, if you're going to settle divisions and settle playoff races against your division rivals at the end of the year. And it's been weighted like that for a while since they went back to the unbalanced schedule, where you don't see the Dodgers as much in May, June, July and August as you would say in April and September. But this year it's just weighted so oddly. The Giants six of their nine home games against the Dodgers are going to be done by May 1st. They're only going to have one more series against the Dodgers the rest of the year, and at LA there's another one in June and another one in August, and they don't play the Dodgers in LA in September. So, they play them again at the end of the year. At home. So there's like that one series that'll end the season mm-hmm. against the Dodgers at home, but there's a huge gap between their last road series there in August and between when they face them again. And I don't know exactly what goes into the scheduling now. It's all done by computers, and there are also rules now that are a little different and more stringent about how much rest you have to give players and teams, traveling between cities. That might play into it as well. You have fewer options of where you can put teams on the schedule, and that may have something to do with it. We'll see if this continues on into next year. I'm not a big fan of the way the Dodgers and Giants are this year.
Right. Another crinkle in terms of the Dodgers coming here now is that we're looking at this atmospheric river, which is our new favorite catchphrase, coming into the Bay Area and possibly affecting the Friday-Saturday games. Henry and I had this conversation yesterday where we were talking about whether to address it and what contingency plans were. And I didn't realize you wrote this in your story. Only five games have been rained out at AT&T Park. Is that right?
I was thinking of, I have Ella Fitzgerald on my mind singing Cry Me an Atmospheric River because I've cried an atmospheric river over you. And our older listeners will get that. I don't think Fernando will, but our older listeners will get that. There have been five rainouts in AT&T, and this is the 19th season. Three of them may have been that very first year. There hasn't been one since 06. We rarely get rainouts in April because the rainstorms that do come in tend to be ones that, it'll rain for a couple hours and then it'll be dry for a couple of hours. So the Giants will have everybody show up at the ballpark, and, if there is a little bit of a delay, they'll make them wait. I don't know that they're going to be able to do that this time if the forecast holds. If they wake up Friday morning and this forecast has not changed, I would hope that the Giants would, for the sake of the fans, for the sake of the players, the media, for city emergency services, the police, make an early call and not make people go through the rigmarole of going to the ballpark for a game that probably wouldn't be played.
Right. And you were saying that they've had to deal with this so few times, is that they generally don't call it, though, until
right.
The day of.
Right. Yeah, because, I mean, the weather here in April, as everybody knows, the weather here in April is extremely changeable from the forecast. This one doesn't look like it is, but usually you're talking about sporadic rain showers. So, I mean, it really doesn't make sense to call a game early because of the possibility that when the game time comes at night that it'll be fine. And that has happened. I mean, that's happened a few times that I can remember. It'd be a little easier to rain this one out, too. The Dodgers, like we've talked about, are coming back here at the end of the month. They have a mutual off day. I believe it's Thursday the 26th. It's 3 weeks from when we're recording this podcast. I think they could play that as the start of a four-game series as opposed to, you know, the start of this three-game series if they needed to. It'll, you know, mess up the pitching, mess up an off day, but it could be done.
Right. Hey, I'm going to end on a sort of Dodgers Giants note. I know your readers certainly know this that you home is in L.A. for you. You grew up down there.
Was
very true. Okay, for both of us, our childhoods were spent there in the shadow of Chavez Ravine, and you know, growing up. I want to ask you about the plumbing problems that also that the Dodgers have run into, which we're kind of used to here for the Coliseum and the A's, but was it a little bit of a I don't know, did you just have to laugh at what they were going through down there?
Well, since I tweeted it about it and joked about it on Twitter about 100 times, yeah, I'd say you do. I mean, they were playing there was the last couple of innings of their what they call the freeway series, just like our Bay Bridge series up here. They were playing a game against the Angels, the very last exhibition before the season started. And all of a sudden, I mean, I'm looking on Twitter. I'm not watching the game, obviously. And I'm looking on Twitter, and people are saying that some sprinklers have come on. Well, then we learned it wasn't exactly sprinklers. It was, depending on what your source, it was either actually untreated sewage or what they call tertiary water or treated sewage. I don't know if many of your listeners know this, but you're allowed to take sewage, clean it up, and put it, you know, water lawns, you know, golf courses, ballparks, all that sort of stuff. The health department, is as much as we have one anymore in this country, says that you can do it. And so that's probably what it was. And the bigger issue wasn't the health hazard from this backup of water, but it actually flooded. The water got into the Dodgers clubhouse and actually flooded the coach's room and the manager's office. And they had 2 days to clean it up, and they did. And there was just no stench when I showed up for that opening day last week.
Well, impressive. So this one thing our Giants Double Play listeners can always count on is learning something new, and here we have a water treatment regulation lesson at the very end.
Yeah, that's why they call me Clavin.
Henry, thanks for joining us as usual. We will catch up with you next time, either in person or on the road.
You got it.
Take care.
This show is part of the San Francisco Chronicle Podcast Network. Our theme music is Horns of Jericho by Lucas Pern and Miloslav Kolar, courtesy of the Free Music Archive. This show is produced by me and Fernando Diaz. For more Giants coverage, you can follow Henry on Twitter at Hank Schulman and me at Janie_Who. Check out all of our coverage at sfchronicle.com.